Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Live Well Bipolar. I have a special guest with me. I'm not alone today, and I want to tell you a little bit about who she is. I feel like I have known this person for a long time. We got connected, like I meet so many of you listening and so many guests who've been on the show on Instagram, and we're going to get into her story today. This is my friend, Anne. She is an almost 11-year breast cancer survivor who is living with both Parkinson's disease and bipolar 1 disorder. She was diagnosed in 2020 at 55 years old and is passionate about educating people about the illness and chipping away at the stigma surrounding it. We're going to be getting into the specifics of her story, also the importance of asking for help, what Anne did to ask for help herself. So Anne, thank you so much for making the time to be here. I'm so happy we're finally bringing this conversation to life. I know we've been trying to get this talking back and forth for so long. So thank you for being here and being willing to share your experiences with us today.
Oh, for sure. No, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to it because I'm happy to share my story and the help, you know, hopes it might help somebody. You know, it's a really tough disease and it's hard to navigate and everyone has their own way of doing it. And, you know, I can just share what I've experienced and hopefully that'll, you know, resonate with some folks out there.
100%. And I couldn't agree with you more because I know you know this because we were talking about the podcast and my story and why I decided to write my book. And we shared each other's experiences. And I said, that's why I started this, to have more people share their lived experience or what they do to make a difference.
Yeah, because hearing
themselves.
Other people's stories is what, you know, makes just you feel like you're not alone.
Right. But I think what you were saying about sharing people's stories and making others not feel alone in that. Something you brought up to me that I think is so interesting. So I want to start with your diagnosis. So something you brought up to me is getting diagnosed so much later in life. Mm-hmm. And you say, especially in 2020, right? Mm-hmm. When we're in the right beginning of the pandemic. So I would love for you to tell me the story today. Walk me through, what was it like when you received your diagnosis?
Well, it was around kind of mid-February, end of February, when this kind of gradually started. And I didn't think anything was wrong. My family in particular was saying I was doing and saying things that I would never normally do or say. But I don't think they understood what was going on, that like I needed help. And I had all of these delusions. Like, it started out with thinking a Netflix documentary crew was following me around. So I would spend all this time, you know, day and night looking for the Netflix crew. Where are they? And, you know, then it would roll into things like I had this imaginary husband and he was like famous, but he wanted to be like kind of undercover about it. And he knew all these famous people around Seattle and we were going to set up a foundation. But then, oh, he was also a writer for SNL, mm-hmm. which is interesting because I've always had an interest and been kind of obsessed with pop culture. So it was like every day I felt like I had like a task I had to do. Like, okay, today I would, you know, something would pop into my mind. I need to do this. So I spent days and days and hours walking around my neighborhood, which thankfully is safe. Mm-hmm. I mean, all night, you know, all day, all night. And then people started to notice, wow, Anne's like throwing away a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. What, you know, what's up with Anne? So then the neighbors are calling 911. The people at the grocery store are calling 911 because I'd lived in the same area for about 20 years. So even they could tell like something was off. I was just wandering around the store. So everyone's calling 911, but you know, they can't do anything unless you're a danger to yourself or others, mm-hmm. which is really unfortunate because that would have saved me a lot of time.
Right.
And a lot of money, you know, because I threw away shoes, my phone, my glasses, coats. I mean, you name it.
So,
and the police force is a little smaller. We're not like a big suburb. And I knew all the officers knew me. They'd all been called, you know, to my home. The mobile crisis unit, they'd all been called. So finally, one day I get into an ambulance. I don't know why. I think I was tired. I was probably hungry. I didn't really have any food.
Mm-hmm.
So I get in the ambulance, and my only concern, I remember asking the officer, are they going to turn on the sirens, you know, for my ride to the hospital? Like, that's what I was concerned about. So I get to the ER, and, you know, you have to go through the whole process where they come and talk to you. And I remember parts of it. I remember, you know, like you see in the movies when someone is coming in to like to give you a shot of something, but you don't want it or don't know what it
right.
is. And I remember like three people coming in and holding me down and giving me an injection. And I said, well, who ordered this? I was like, you know, who ordered this? What is it? Anyway,
the same thing happened to me. The same exact thing.
Oh, really?
Same
thing. And I wasn't even being like disruptive or anything. At least, who knows? Maybe I was. So the next thing I know, I wake up in a different place, kind of half awake, half not, get registered. So then I'm in the psychiatric unit for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They never told me at the hospital what my diagnosis was.
Wow.
They never said, oh, hey, Anne, the reason you're here at this hospital in this particular unit where people are having like a harder time is because, you know, you had a manic episode with psychotic features and it's bipolar one, and you were wandering around for 2 months in your neighborhood before you came here. No one said anything about that.
Did they give you any diagnosis, or just they didn't tell?
They didn't tell me anything. The main thing they were concerned about, and I'll never forget this. Apparently, when I first got there, which I don't remember, I was trying to get into other patients' belongings. Like, there was three people to a room in this particular hospital, and everyone had like kind of a footlocker if they had personal belongings. So I guess I was like rifling through their stuff, which, you know, obviously I normally would never do.
Yeah.
And the psychiatrist, I'll never forget, he would just sat there every time I met with him. Well, but you were trying to get into other people's things, you know.
Wow.
So that wasn't really particularly very helpful. I didn't really know why I was there. At one point I noticed that, you know, they have those, the techs, they call them the
yes.
mental health techs. And I noticed that one was like by my, like 24/7 by my side. And in my still state of delusion, I thought it was like a bodyguard. I thought my imaginary husband had sent a bodyguard to make sure I was safe in the psychiatric hospital.
Right.
And I remember saying to her at one point, you know, you don't need to like follow me around the time. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, you know, right now the people upstairs say that's what we have to do. So that went on for a while. I mean, they had to sit in my room and watch me sleep.
How long was your hospitalization? Because I know I have a lot of the same experiences. Mine was 2 weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
It
but
was
didn't
court
it feel
ordered.
Didn't it feel, yeah, court ordered. Mine was court ordered too. Didn't it feel like you were there for years though? Because I know that that's.
Yeah, because I didn't really, you know what happened when I first got there. I remember them getting me registered and showing me my room. And then I don't know how many, I would guess maybe 3 days went by when I was like in this blackout sleepwalk stage. Because there was other people that were having a pretty hard time. And I also thought that the other patients were like characters in this documentary about me, right? So there is a stereotypical like jock. You think, oh, that's the dumb jock. He was actually like really, really smart. And oh, that's the kind of, you know, flower child, you know, hippy dippy girl who sleeps with, you know, her head at the other end of the bed. Just, you know, a cast of characters that were really interesting. The texts were all really great, I'll have to say. But when I got home, because I kept saying, I want to go home, I want to go home. You know, and they're, no, not yet. I didn't know, you know, really what was going on. And at this point, I'm a little more coherent, but the medication they had me on was pretty sedating.
Right, me too.
And then one day, and I had told you this story, one of my friends called me who had been trying to track me down. She lives in Florida. She was getting concerned because I wasn't answering her texts or calls or anything. So she like got a hold of, I don't know, a family member, but she called and said, one of the first things she said was, don't feel embarrassed or have any shame about this. So not even knowing what my diagnosis is, or really much about anything that's gone on. And I had mentioned this to you the other day. I was like, well, why would I? It like never even crossed my mind.
Wow.
And I don't know why that is. I mean, I have some theories.
Yeah.
But I was like, why would I? Because when I went through my cancer experience, it was pretty brutal. And so I shared all of that pretty openly on Facebook. I kind of used it as a like a blog, because I had, you know, relatives and friends out of town.
Right.
And I just got used to sharing kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly. But I was like, I don't, you know, that's not going to be a problem. I just thought it was weird that she even mentioned it.
I think something that sticks out for me is you talk about also, because I know for me, I was also hospitalized for 2 weeks, court-ordered treatment. And you say the meds were very sedating, and that was my same experience. There's a lot that I do remember, but there's a lot that I don't fully have that full picture. So I'd love to ask you, when you finally were leaving the hospital, going back to being home, did you feel like, because I know for me, I feel like I left and I came back into the real world without any real resources. I just felt like I was kind of thrown back, and I didn't feel like I had any kind of reassurance of, okay, here's your bipolar diagnosis. Here's what you should probably take a look at for your life, or here's some things you can manage. I had none of that. So did you feel like you had any kind of support, or also nothing, really?
Also nothing. And one of the hardest parts of this whole experience, since I didn't know what my diagnosis was or what had happened, when I opened the door, I didn't even have my key. The property manager, so kind, really helped me out a lot once I got home. I opened the door and I was like, what the? It looked like a bomb had gone off. Like, I had the window screens had like big holes punched in them. My disposal didn't work. It turned out I shoved my debit card into my disposal.
Wow.
Don't know why. I walked into my bedroom and looked in the closet. I'm like, where's all my shoes? Oh, not one resource about, you know, here's like the crisis line if you need to talk to somebody. I think they did like schedule appointment with my psychiatrist, maybe.
Yeah. Were you, because you said you were court ordered. So I was also court ordered. So I had appointments that I had to go to, or else I would be taken back. So maybe you had those appointments. That's kind of what they said for me. It was, I just do remember that of, you have to go to these appointments with this doctor. If you don't, and you don't follow what we're, you know, you don't get your blood checked, you don't do these certain things, then we could just have you go back to the hospital.
Oh yeah. I never heard anything like that. It was just like, you need to, you know, follow up with your primary care and psychiatrist, who I'd had for like 10 plus years. And I should have fired years before in hindsight. But so it wasn't until I talked to her maybe 3 days later that I found out what the diagnosis was.
Oh, and that's, and she's the one who told you.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I had to, I mean, I live by myself. I don't have any family close by. I had an upstairs neighbor that went to Target and got me a burner phone because I didn't have a phone. Thank God I didn't throw away my laptop. I threw all this stuff out, the front and the back of my condo. I was just like purging stuff. And I didn't have a fear of like, oh, I'm going to have to go back there. You know, I knew I wanted to have the appointments, but the doctor kept me on the same medication for a while that they had me on at the hospital. And I was like, you know, that's kind of sedating. I don't really want to be taking that. I can't remember what it was. It begins with an H.
Haldol, hold.
Haldol, maybe.
Yeah, something like
Does that
that.
sound
Because
familiar?
I was, that's the thing is, I feel the same exact way as you. And I remember coming home and feeling like the same thing you said, not even crisis line, no resources. So, something I want to ask you is you talk about not being afraid to ask for help. So, I'd love for you to break that down. What did that look like at this point in your story? What did you do to reach out to ask for help? Because I don't want to give away the piece of what it is. So I want to pass it over to you to kind of share what that looks like.
Well, when I got home, I was really struggling because I knew I wasn't on the right medication. I didn't feel good. I didn't really have a full understanding of what had happened, you know, and I think you go through kind of a grieving process, you know, when you're diagnosed with something like this, which I just kind of heard about a couple of weeks ago. And I'm like, oh, because the first step in the grieving process is denial. So I didn't, it's like I just felt like a fish out of water. So I was like plodding along, just. I knew I also had to put looming ahead of me. I got home from the hospital in May. I knew by the end of the year I had to pack up my condo, get it on the market, and sell it to avoid foreclosure. This is all by myself, pretty much. And I'm like barely moving. You know, I would just, to get up and eat anything was just like too much effort. And then at a certain point, it was about a month after I got home, I would lay in bed and think of like, you know, what would it be like if I just wasn't here? It wasn't like I had these thoughts like, you know, I want to kill myself. It wasn't like that. But I was having kind of scary thoughts like, well, how could I even do that here in my condo? Like, I didn't have any weapons. I can't stand the sight of blood. You know, I wouldn't have like used a knife to hurt myself. But those were the kind of thoughts that I was having. And since I still didn't really have any resources, I just called 911. And the officer, the responding officer I had met before, probably on multiple occasions when she'd come to help me, and she said, I'll never forget this because she said, you know, it was really brave of you to call and ask for help. She said, because a lot of people don't. And I said, well, brave is the last thing I feel right now. I said, but I appreciate, you know, she's so kind. They were all so kind and trying to help me. So then I went to the second inpatient hospital, which was like a Four Seasons compared to the first one, which was like a not a great Motel 6. But I had a lot of like physical health issues going on when I was there, and they made some medication changes and didn't really help. So then I didn't really feel ready to go home. Went home, ended up back. And these were voluntary visits, you know, it wasn't court ordered. I ended up doing that a total of three times because I just was like yelling for help, like, someone help me. You know, I don't feel like myself. I'm not doing anything. You know, all I would do is like, I meet with my realtor who is very patient because it took me a long time to even sign the papers. And you know, go to my appointments, go to the store. And it wasn't until about September that I sat down because people were starting to message me on Facebook because I didn't have my phone and asking, you know, what's up? We haven't seen you online. And I thought, well, I really need to put out there what happened. And I didn't have any qualms about doing that. And I tried to make it a little lighthearted because I felt like I was in a TV show, you know, especially later on in the voluntary hospitals where the scrubs were orange. So it was like Orange is the New Black, hospital okay. version. And so I tried to make it kind of, you know, a little bit lighthearted, but, and, you know, everyone was really supportive, lots of kind comments. But then after that, it was just kind of like crickets.
I wanted to ask you this because I think something very different with your story is you say, I had no qualms about sharing my story and doing that. There's so many people that I've spoken with who said that they got to that point later on. It took them years and years and years. But I would love to know if you can think of anything that stood out for you with how you were able to do that and have the mindset you did. Because I know even for myself, with me sharing my experiences living with bipolar, I feel like in the beginning, I kind of would say it a little bit, but then I stopped because I did have a lot of fear and shame around judgment and losing relationships. And I've had a lot of bad experiences because of it. But right. as a result of continuing to share, it's been nothing but support and learning new tools. So was there something in particular that stuck out for you to have you be that way? It's so rare for me to hear that. It's rare and it's amazing.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I did a podcast back in 2021 with a breast cancer friend, and she was doing a series on mental health and breast cancer. And at the end, she was kind of asking me the same thing. And I said, well, I feel like it's like my duty or something, you know, purpose. I feel like it's my job. I feel like it's my duty. I don't, it just comes from somewhere within, I guess. Because I literally never felt any of those feelings.
Wow.
I felt discouraged and disappointed that so many people had so little knowledge about the disease. That was hard for me. And that was part of the grieving process, because one of the steps is anger. You know, people were treating me differently. I didn't like that. It just kind of made things worse. So I kind of went through an anger phase, and then I went through kind of an education phase where I was trying to, you know, explain to people, like, no, literally I was out of my mind. And it's not, even if I'm remembering things, I'm still out of my mind. You know, and I learned along the way a lot more about it too, you know, in the last 4 years. So it's been a learning experience, but I also just get a lot of, I don't know if personal satisfaction is the right way to say it, but it just makes me feel really good.
Purpose.
To connect with people. Like, I have a local friend who we got together one day, and who mentioned that they had, you know, mental health issues, and I had no idea. And I was able to give them some resources, like about the NAMI support group and, you know, things like that. And I love that kind of stuff. I've always loved like bringing people together and recommending things and that kind of stuff. So I'm really glad that I'm still able to do that, you know, just in a different arena.
I think that's so amazing. And I think something else to note about you is you talk about the different stages of the grieving process. And I think something else that sticks out for me is when we're talking about your story, right? You talk about dealing with, on top of managing bipolar disorder, being a almost 11-year breast cancer survivor, Parkinson's disease. And like you said, something that was helpful for you along the way of your journey, you say, you mentioned NAMI. So that being a great resource for the support groups and things like that. I would love to see, how did you come across NAMI? Did someone introduce you to them? Did you just find them on Google? How did that come into play for you?
Well, I was familiar with that organization and had been for several years due to another family member having mental illness. And I think it was my counselor that recommended their support groups. And it's been, I want to say, a couple of years. You know, I have to miss, I've had to miss them a lot because I've had a really bad stretch so far this year with my health.
Right.
But it's kind of a core group, and then people come and go. But it's very, you know, interactive, and you can hear other people's challenges. And I always feel like I have, you know, something to interject that might help somebody, you know, because a lot of, well, it's kind of a mixed bag as far as age. There's another friend that's a little bit older than me, but I remember one of them saying, you know, thank you for your wisdom. And I was like, wisdom? Oh my gosh.
And that's
Yeah.
how, no, I feel like ever since we connected, I know when I went through just a lot of the struggles earlier this year with just like all the physical health stuff, you were playing the doctor, Anne, and like being able to
Right.
help out. And it was so helpful because I feel like that is what makes such a difference, just having someone who can even listen to you. Sometimes just listening, just being able to share, like you said, you're a connector. Meeting your friend who says, I also deal with mental illness, and saying, I had no idea. Here's some resources that can help. I think that's really what's so beautiful about the person that you are. It's just this heart that you have. And I said, what was it that got you to from the right from the beginning to speak so openly about your experiences? And you said, you talk about having that purpose and duty and feeling like it's that calling and part of your job of doing this. So I feel like I felt that ever since we connected. And I remember just being able to see the similarities and our experiences as far as the hospitalization goes and different things like that. But that's what I love so much about you. And I'd love to ask you this because I always ask my guests this question because you never know what answer you will get from everyone. It's great to see all the different responses, but and I'd love to ask.
It's coming.
I know you're like, I'm getting ready for this. So, as you know, the podcast is Live Well Bipolar. So, I would love to ask you at this point in your life right now, what does it mean to live well bipolar?
You know, to me, because my bipolar has been so up and down, you know, this year I had 4 weeks solid when I was stuck in what I call Kansas. I'll tell everyone about my Wizard of Oz analogy. When I don't feel well, when I'm in a bipolar depression, I call it Kansas. And when I'm feeling good, like myself, then I'm in Oz. But when you have 4 weeks where it's just like the lights are off, nobody's home, you don't have any interest in anything, it's hard to feel like, well, I have this disease, I have this illness, and I'm trying to, you know, live with it. How do you live well with it when you have this kind of stuff going on? But I'm really hopeful, and I always say this, that anytime we make a medication change, maybe this is like the secret sauce. You know, this the cocktail that's going to be the right balance, so I'm not, you know, just flat and not doing anything and just able to function and feel like myself. Because then I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy. I feel, you know, just like myself again. You know, because I don't like to listen to music or read or do anything, and it's just like a waste of time, I guess. So to live well would be to not have to deal with that. I would like to just live well bipolar in Oz.
I love the way that you break that down of explaining what does that look like, right? When I spent those 4 weeks, you say in Kansas, and then like that's a analogy, interesting one that you use, because it reminds me of my mom actually played the Wicked Witch in the Wizard of Oz play. So that just came to mind, just picturing the whole play playing out in my mind. But I think to say being able to live well means living without that, right? And what does that look like? You know, to think about people who have that and really just being able to say with the supports that you've been able to put into place with being part of the support groups and just being that resource and sharing your story, that's something that's helped me see that in you. When you talk about what can I do to take these experiences that have been very challenging. And I'm going to talk about it. You know, I'm going to say, I've gone through this period of depression. I've gone through these dark days and I'm still having them. They're still coming up. They're never going to go away. And that's what I always try to remember too, for me, when I'm still going through that, of who are those people that I can reach out to and that I can have these conversations with. And you are one of those people for me. And I know you're one of those people for so many in our community. And it's the people that we have, whether it's on social media or wherever it is. But Anne, I just want to turn it over to you too and let you share if there's any last words or messages that you would like to share with us before I ask you to share. Where can people go to get more of you and stay connected with you?
Okay. Final last words. I guess one wish I have is for people, if you know someone that has had a bipolar diagnosis, to educate yourself a little bit about it. Don't have to be an expert. Have some compassion for them. You know, not having that for all these folks, like, you know, even you said, they don't tell people, they feel the shame and all that. That just breaks my heart. It literally breaks my heart to have to feel, even though I felt like I didn't have that much support, mm-hmm. you know, I had like a little group of support, but I can't imagine that. So I just, you know, I always hope that in trying to share with people, you know, have compassion for people. We don't want this illness. You know, we're not making this stuff up. This is something we have to navigate every single day. And sometimes you don't know day to day. Like when I woke up today, I'm like, well, I hope I feel good because I have these plans. And luckily, I'm a little bit tired, but that's okay. But just, you know, allow people some grace that are dealing with these types of things, because it's hard. It's hard to navigate.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I love how you touched on the compassion and education of educating yourself, not having to be an expert, but really putting yourself in this person's shoes and knowing that it's not easy to live with this for the rest of your life. But what can we do to support each other, support those we love who are living with bipolar? And I think that you brought up so many good points and just your story, especially, you know, Anne, I want to thank you for making the time to come out and share this, but can you let us know where people can go to get connected with you and stay in touch with you?
Oh, no, I would love that. On Instagram, my handle is Little Bird by Anne, and I call it that. I have kind of a fondness for birds because my late mom liked birds and watching them in the bird bath. So I just kind of came up with that. And I don't have a Substack account yet, but I'm planning on setting one up. And so Instagram really is the main place. So definitely come by. It's not strictly bipolar because I have the other, you know, I have breast cancer friends on there. I've got Parkinson's friends. I like to take pictures of flowers. And so I'll put those in there. So it's kind of a mixed bag, which I think, you know, some people like that, some people don't, but that's just how I have it set up. But yeah, I try to share things that I've learned along the way that, you know, maybe something I learned during my breast cancer. I hate the word journey for me, it never resonated, but during my treatment and whatnot, things that helped me then also can help people with Parkinson's and bipolar. There's a lot of tools and things just that I've learned along the way that actually can help pretty much, you know, everyone. Yeah. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but I really enjoy finding things to post. And
yeah, so I will have that in the show notes. And yeah, you guys can go connect with her. And it's been so great just getting to know you offline. And that's really what we do, is just we have so many messages there going back and forth and just supporting each other, right? And being able to open up and say, you know, what we're dealing with in real time, it's made a big difference for me. So on that note, I want to thank you guys for making the time to come out here and listen and tune in to Anne's story today. I hope you guys took away as much value from this as I have had putting it together for you. And I want to thank you, Anne, again, for being here. And you guys, I hope you have a good rest of the day or night, depending on when you are listening to this. And I'm going to go ahead and end it here and say bye to you guys and bye to Anne. So yes, bye guys.
Thank you so much, bye, Paris.
Of course.